Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 546, titled Barry and the Milieu, being recorded on March 26th of the year 2006. And once again, it is my pleasure and privilege to bring Daniel Hopsicker back to our airwaves. And Daniel, of course, is the author of, among other titles, Barry and the Boys and Welcome to Terrorland, as well as numerous articles available on his madcowprod.org website, or .com, excuse me, website. Anyway, Daniel, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Dave, pleasure to be with you. Barry and his milieu?
Yeah, well, that's sort of an in-joke here on For the Record. Let me explain something. When we were talking last time, and something I'd like to, a subject to which I'd like to return, we were talking about what I like to call evidentiary tributaries that run between not only both of your books, Barry and the Boys and Welcome to Terrorland, but also through many of your articles, particularly articles on September 11th and then overlapping to an extent the investigation into September 11th. And we were using the definition of the boys, you know, this networking and this gallery of personalities always to a certain extent in flux and yet always staying the same that runs through Barry and the Boys, Welcome to Terrorland, many of your articles. It is the boys, or as I call it, a milieu, because a lot of people, you know, who've listened to the show for a long time, they hear it, and I get ribbed a fair amount about it, but there just aren't a lot of good synonyms for what I'm talking about when I use milieu. But the things that you look at, the things that come under spotlight Hopsicker or searchlight or magnifying glass Hopsicker are things that run all the way from the assassination of President Kennedy all the way on up through Watergate, the Iran-Contra scandal, and a lot of things that have taken place since then, and right on up through some of the scandals that are unfolding in Washington. But when I use the word milieu, which I often do, and when people get inclined to chuckle about it, it's the boys, really. I mean, that would be a good synonym, but it's the kind of a network that we're going to be talking about today and that we've spoken about to one extent or another in many of our past discussions with Daniel. Speaking of Daniel, new editions coming out of Barry and the Boys, Welcome to Terrorland. When can we expect them, and can you give us a preview of what we can expect to see in them?
Well, first let's talk about milieu.
Okay. what about milieu?
It's funny that give that introduction, because it is exactly what I'm writing about for tomorrow. The title, the working title of the story I'm putting up tomorrow is called Jack Abramoff and the Permanent Scandal. I was trying to think of a way to convey the permanence of the organization and its recurrence in scandal that Abramoff belongs to. It is kind of a permanent scandal. The names change, but the organization that is being referenced remains the same. How odd. So our minds are similar paths, but I don't know that I haven't. One of the few gratifying things about what I do is that a significant portion of my audience are people that were there. I'm pleased with that.
Uh-huh.
I think we'll lose a few if we start throwing around words like milieu.
Well, you know, it's hard. There aren't any good words that really sum up what it is I'm talking about. But you really can't pause to lay it all out or even a portion of it out when you're using that word in a context that highlights something else.
Let me speak to exactly the point that you've been making, and use something that happened to me last weekend.
Sure.
To illustrate it. It's the permanent scandal, the milieu. We're both talking about the same thing, and an incident last weekend sort of throws it into highlight. I was over in Boca Raton speaking at a Borders bookstore, along with a guy who ran a sting for the federal government, where they caught a couple of three or four Arab guys in New Jersey who were looking for nuclear triggers.
Uh-huh.
Randy Glass, basically sort of a mobbed up fellow who ran afoul of the law, and then went and did this really good thing, and you know, if he didn't want like New Jersey to blow up, for the government. So we speak at the bookstore, and my my primary reason for going over there was to meet this guy, Glass, who's been on 60 Minutes a few times.
Oh, this was Randy Glass.
Randy Glass.
He's the guy who was involved with helping to shed light on Moishin, Dia Moishin, and some of the people around Dr. Magdi El-Amir.
And in the course of that case, I learned something that would later prove very significant to my investigation down here. The federal prosecutor in that case, during the trial, introduced it saying that this was the typical deal between the terrorists and their counterparts here in the U.S. was oil and heroin for guns and training. In other words, they supplied oil and heroin, we supplied guns and training. And when I discovered that the flight school owners, Learjet, had been found with 43 pounds of heroin the month Atta arrived.
Parenthetically, that's Wally Hilliard. Go ahead.
Correct.
Right.
You know, I could see the same thing was going on here. Okay? I mean, because of this guy, Randy Glass. At any rate, he knows more about Gus Boulos than probably I'll ever know or ever learn. I mean, if I make a life history of it, I was just hoping that he would let a few crumbs dribble from his lips. But he would not.
I can't understand why.
Well, and that's what I'm getting to. In a roundabout and friendly way, I was warned that pursuing Jack Abramoff's connection to the Gus Boulos murder was potentially something that could get me killed. And, you know, and the reason would, of course, be, and that's what I said, okay, in other words, we are once again threatening to compromise current operations. They don't mind if you write or read about things that happened 20 years ago. But when you're threatening to compromise, and that's when it hit me that Jack Abramoff is going to jail for a few years. But those unregulated gambling ships are all still here. There are 26 of them parked around the state of Florida. Together, they probably represent one of the world's largest slush funds. They are completely unregulated. If you go on one of these gambling ships out of Fort Lauderdale and you find out that the dice are weighted or rigged, there was no one to complain to. Okay, this is Vegas.
Not above the surface of the water.
This is Vegas before Bugsy Siegel.
Yeah.
When the ship gets back, there's no way of knowing how much money it took in. There's no one there to count the receipts. There's 26 casinos, unregulated, in Florida, kicking off ungodly sums of money. Abramoff took in $86 million from the Indians over a couple of years. This yearly must kick off at least that every year.
Well, it certainly was lucrative enough to attract the sort of attention that Gus Boulos received, and that's why, you know, when you hear, yeah.
Follow me here.
Yeah, okay.
So Jack Abramoff's mouth has been removed from one end of the feeding tube, but the feeding tube is still exists, and fluid is pumping through it even as we speak. And that money has got to be making its way into the same pockets that it was going into when Jack Abramoff was running it.
Well, you know, at the risk of seeming a little corny, the line from Casablanca where Louis Renault, you know, the police chief and Vichy collaborator, who's ordered to clear the casino by Major Strasser, says, "I'm shocked to learn that there's gambling going on these premises." And I guess that would sum up my feelings about as effectively as anything. You know, I mean, with all of the attendant irony, right?
These guys can't lose. For example, when Wally Hilliard was judged to be not an innocent owner, victimized by an unscrupulous drug trafficker.
Pause right there. Daniel Walla Hilliard partners with Rudy Deckers and the real boss of Huffman Aviation, through which Mohammed Atta and the hijackers infiltrated and pursued their ends. Go ahead, Daniel.
Right. When he was judged not to be an innocent owner and his plane was seized, what that meant was the plane was taken from Wally Hilliard and given back to the lien holder. In other words, it was GE credit. And so Hilliard didn't lose anything because he was just making monthly payments. And the trafficking operation didn't lose the jet because it just went back to GE credit, which had furnished it to Hilliard to begin with. And tracking it up to the present, several of Hilliard's planes have been used in the extractions that have recently been in the news. Plane spotters, God bless them, I'm amazed. I mean, there are actually people who know how to, like, go out and do things.
Now, when you talk about extractions, you're talking about some of these illicit flights where people are rendered, terrorist suspects are rendered back to their countries of origin where they get basically special deliveries, so to speak.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. One of Hilliard's Learjets is involved in that. Whether it's still physically registered to Hilliard doesn't really matter. You know, once those planes, I mean, if your job is to take a fleet of 300 planes and keep anybody from knowing who owns them, like the CIA, what you do is you run them through 40 different names. But you still have the same 300 plane fleet. So if one of Wally Hilliard's Learjets, a Learjet that was flying under his name 3-4 years ago, is today doing renditions, extraditions, whatever they call them, of suspected terrorists from one country to another, that plane still belongs to the same people that owned it when Wally Hilliard's name was on it. And by extension, the gambling ships around the state of Florida that Jack Abramoff got his name on are still functioning and still putting money into the same people's pockets as it did when Jack Abramoff ran it. Otherwise, Dave, I would not have received a death threat for threatening to compromise current operations.
Yeah, well,
Jack Abramoff's removal from the gambling ship industry in Florida had cleaned it up and everything was Jake today, there'd be no current operations for me to threaten to compromise by poking my nose into it.
Uh-huh.
Would there?
No, it makes a lot of sense. You know, and we should add in that regard, not only that, but I think there's another factor involved too, Daniel, and that is that with, a Tony Soprano-style whack, basically, right in the immediate background of big-time GOP politics at a time when Bush's ratings are already pretty low. Oh, and then, when all of a sudden, George Bush's second term and the Sopranos become virtually indistinguishable, at least as far as this goes, there are other reasons why this is such a hot potato and why you've basically been told if you can't take the heat, stay out of the kitchen. Perhaps not the worst of advice. I'll tell you this, you've already done a very good job. Remember, too, that Mohammed Atta and company visited a Sun Cruise casino boat in the immediate run-up to September 11th. Apparently, not just the ones we'd spoken about previously, but in our last discussion, you mentioned up to 4 visits by Atta and company in the run-up to September 11th. So who knows how far that investigation goes?
There are 4 separate news accounts from around the state of Florida of citizens reporting seeing terrorists on boats before September 11th. 4. I discovered 4, not just the one that is now known about Atta. 4. So whatever that means.
You know what it does mean. The point being that there are a number of reasons why that communication, that death threat, would have been delivered. So I just didn't want to note that in passing. In one sense, it doesn't surprise me. I mean, the stuff. The stuff that you've been talking about is really quite remarkable. And again, as you pointed out, when you're talking about the Kennedy assassination or even the Iran-Contra affair, the death of Barry Seal, or, you know, the Afghan war, that was X number of years ago, you know. But now, when you talk about current ops...
Let's just bring it up to the current. Because I asked, while I was in the presence of these mobbed-up folks in Boca Raton, it's hard to not bump into them in Boca Raton, I asked this question. I said, Gus Bulis was murdered just a couple weeks after George W. Bush assumed the presidency. Gus Bulis is also reported in news reports to have been associated with Bonanno mobsters from the Bonanno family.
Mm-hmm.
The three going on trial for Bulis's murder are all Gambino associates, including Big Tony, who was a member of John Gotti's crew.
And let's stop right there just for a second, Daniel. Now, Big Tony Moscatello is one of the people accused in the murder of Gus Bulis. Now, previously, talking about the kind of long-term networking and institutional operations that we're talking about, the guy who helped to bring information against Tony Moscatello in an earlier drug bust was Bud Drug Bust, and your ladies was Barry Seal, the focal point of your first book. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's a small world at this level. So the question I asked this guy was, given that Bulis was murdered just a couple weeks after Bush took over,
and
Bulis had Bonanno associates and was murdered by Gambino torpedoes, might the change in administrations, you know, if that was on the surface, might there have been an even larger tectonic shift beneath the surface? I said, for example, the Democratic Party is, at least by Republicans, accused of consisting of unions, minorities, and the mob. And might the election of George W. Bush in the year 2000 and the subsequent murder of Gus Bulis be illustrative of the mob's larger realignment? And the answer I got to that question was that's exactly the kind of thing that could get me whacked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, it.
That's what's really of interest, right? If you're sitting on the outside, like you and I are, reading the daily paper, wondering what's going on in the world around you.
Sure.
You're kind of interested in ultimately, you know, the struggles going on beneath the surface, and that would this would be that struggle. This would be that. And part of the answer I got was why did I think Al Gore had not protested more vigorously? And I guess apparently the people in power are quite a bit stronger than any opposition they might face.
Well, you know, among the things that I think a lot of people should factor in is, you know, I think that there are more people who understand, for example, the findings of the House Select Committee on Assassinations in the late 70s, an official congressional body which found that there had been a conspiracy behind Kennedy's assassination and recommended the investigation by the Department of Justice of David Ferry and the anti-Castro Cubans in New Orleans. That's who Garrison was after. I mean, information has been around for a long time,
and
if people want to use it, they can go ahead and do that. You know,
one line, that's what I learned in Louisiana, 3 years in Louisiana writing Barry and the Boys, was that Garrison was right.
Mm-hmm. He was absolutely right, and information that was disclosed after the JFK movie and the declassification of a lot of documents revealed that the deputy counsel to the House Select Committee in charge within the New Orleans phase of the investigation concluded that Clay Shaw had either been one of the planners of or a cutout to the planners of one of the assassination. You know, and that was Garrison's second suspect. So when one takes that and then you take a look at what you're talking about, with Barry and the Boys. Barry Seal was part of David Ferry's Civil Air Patrol unit and appears to have been a teenage covert operator, so to speak, recalling the the B-grade horror movies of the time. So that you followed a lot of this stuff for a long time. And, you know, potentially an awful lot of skeletons could come out of a lot of closets.
Well, see, here's the deal. Garrison was right, but it didn't get him anywhere.
Oh, got him someplace. It didn't get him anyplace. Good, you know.
And I'm right, and it's not getting me anywhere. I mean,
speaking of all the wonderful things that all the wonderful benefits you've derived from this. Now, you're now facing yet another lawsuit, this on behalf of a German whom you don't want me to mention. You know,
I'm settling it because I can't afford what it would take to.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm agreeing never to mention this guy's name again.
All right.
But I can tell you now, I don't believe I've spoken to you since the deposition, have I?
We talked about the fact that, let's say WB. Can you talk about him?
Oh, Matt, because
oh, yeah, okay. Wolfgang Boringer. Okay, now he was another.
We're continuing. The settlement requires that I never mention this first German pilot's name again.
All right. The other one.
He is the link to the more important guy, Wolfgang Boringer, who Muhammad Atta called my brother.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in the course of the deposition, Dave, see, now you're such a bright guy. You're probably one of the few people in the world that's really going to get what I'm about to tell you. I mean, I walked away from that deposition knowing I would have to settle, but also feeling in like I had done something. And here's what I did. We got an admission from him that fully confirmed that Wolfgang Boringer is an associate of Muhammad Atta's.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And let me tell you how that came about. Amanda Keller, you know, we had asked her as much as we could about each of the seven non-Arab individuals. She knew some of their first and last names, but not all. And she did not know Wolfgang's last name. She did not know his last name. What she did know is that once he arrived on the scene, he and Muhammad Atta were inseparable. That they Atta acted as if they had known each other for a long time, that Atta called him my brother. And she said, he did tell me that he had won his green card in a lottery.
Mm-hmm. By the way, Daniel, parenthetically, before you continue with this, because it's very significant, neither you nor I had heard of that before. A number of people checked in with me. Apparently, it is not that unusual. They have them in Canada, among other places. Go ahead.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I discovered that, too. And I think your readers or your listeners, some of them emailing me. I mean, it sounded odd. I had never heard of it, and I didn't know.
Me neither.
They could have told her anything, and she'd have believed it.
But what's important about that is that it's a corroborative detail for other information.
Well, and that's what I'm about to tell you.
Right, go ahead.
We were questioning this man whose name I'll never mention again,
mm-hmm.
To find out how he knew him, and what he knew of him. And in the course of asking him questions, he said yes. He said, well, Wolfgang won his green card in a lottery, which was total corroboration of what Amanda Keller told us. Anytime I've... You know, she told us a ton of stuff, and everything I discovered after interviewing her confirmed what she said. Nothing ever once has negated it. And here, Wolfgang Boringer, Amanda Keller says that she and Muhammad Atta hung out with Wolfgang, a guy who'd won his green card in a lottery, a German pilot.
Mm-hmm. And that was corroborated.
And this man whose name I won't be able to mention tells us that this German pilot, Wolfgang Boringer, who he worked with and for, won his green card in a lottery.
Quickly, Danny, because we're almost out of time on this side.
Well, what that proves is, I mean, it's as if I was, to come up with the name of someone that Lee Harvey Oswald hung out with in the months before the Kennedy assassination, whose name you'd never heard of, came off the wall. Pierce Salinger.
It's huge. It's huge, Daniel, and you deserve a lot of credit. Maybe some people think I'm being corny or fatuous when I refer to you as heroic. You know, I can almost hear you blush on the other end of the mic here, you know, but it's true. I mean, you paid some very heavy dues, and, you know, you're not going to get any sort of medal, and yet the stuff that you've done at considerable risk and expense to yourself has shed an awful lot of light on some very, very important dynamics, which not only have taken a lot of life in the past, but more importantly, which threatened to take a great deal more life in the future if they aren't effectively dealt with. And what you've done is to give people who are resisting that an awful lot more ammunition and an awful lot more information that they're going to need to try and do something about it. And under the circumstances, that makes you a hero.
I'd rather be rich.
Yeah, but you can't win them all there, Bucko. Listen, we are just about finished here. Very quickly, tell us about your website and also where they can get the where and when they can get the two new editions of, respectively, Barry and the Boys and Welcome to Terrorland, Muhammad Atta and the 9/11 cover-up in Florida.
They're both paperbacks, and they're 4 or 6 weeks away.
All right.
Before that, I'll have a Mad Cow Prod. I'm just finishing a new documentary, which will then become a book over the next few months called Bushfellas.
All righty.
Bushfellas. So but tomorrow, as a matter of fact, you'll be able to pre-order a DVD of Bushfellas, which is subtitled, I think, Casino Jack and the Republican Thuggies.
Daniel, very quickly on side two, I want to talk about something else, some other heavy dues you paid. We were talking about Mr. Boringer. Last week you mentioned that his father owned not only the Flying Club of Munich, to which Wolfgang belonged, but also a fleet of taxicabs, and a lot of things that made him to appear to be much more than just a boy aviator, so to speak. I was speaking to a mutual acquaintance for whom we have a mutual respect, and that person mentioned that you had actually had a very interesting conversation with Wolfgang and the charming Mrs. Boringer. Tell us about that very quickly. We've only got a short time, but we'll pick it up again on side two.
I went to his house to interview him, and he wasn't home, and left a business card in his door. And 2 hours later, as I was driving back to Florida, received a phone call from him, a threatening phone call, telling me that what I should do is turn around and come back to Atlanta so that the police could arrest me.
Interesting.
For leaving my business card on your front door? His wife was on the other end of the phone. I assume this is the wife that he met while sailing around the world and making an unexpected left turn into Bombay. And I realized from the tone of voice that these two people were using with me that they had been trained to intimidate people,
mm-hmm.
to intimidate civilians. That the way they were speaking to me was the way I had been spoken to a couple times in the past, and each time by someone who had professional training in intimidating civilians that got in the way. So this guy's an agent, I guarantee it. Just from the way he was speaking. I mean, it just wasn't normal. If you'd have heard it, you'd have thought the same thing. You know how policemen have a voice of command? You know, put your hands on your head, right? It sounds like the voice of God. They're trained to do that. And similarly, spies are trained, if in the situation in which they've lost control, to attempt to intimidate the individual that they're talking to. And that's exactly what happened to me. So, for me, that was confirmation of everything I had suspected of this guy. And he sits there today in Atlanta, Atlanta, Georgia,
mm-hmm.
flying, protected. He's been given U.S. citizenship, of all things.
Well, nice work if you can get it. He got it. We'll talk more about it on side two. This concludes side one of For the Record program number 546. Interview with Daniel Hopsicker, Barry in the Milieu, being recorded on March 26th of the year 2006. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.